This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Stephen Mufsen, is a journalist who witnessed much of the Black uprising in South Africa from 1984 to 86. Evidence of a rebellious spirit was everywhere during these fighting years, he says. To suppress public displays of protest, the government called up tens of thousands of troops and twice declared a state of emergency. More than 2,500 people were killed in political violence. Mufsen wrote about South Africa for the Wall Street Journal, Business Week, and the New Republic. The government of South Africa expelled him in 1987. Mufsen is now a staff writer for the Washington Post and has written a new book about the mid-80s called Fighting Years, Black Resistance and the Struggle for a New South Africa. He's now completing an article analyzing the events of 1990 in South Africa for publication in the next edition of Foreign Affairs. Factional violence between black South Africans in the Natal province has killed at least 4,000 people since 1986. Much of the conflict is between supporters of the African National Congress and members of the Zulu Inkatha movement led by Chief Gotcha Buthelezi. I asked Stephen Mufsen about the political differences between the two groups.
Well, I think to understand the differences, you need to go back to describe what the relationship between them has been over the years. Chief Buthelezi was a member of the African National Congress. He was a member of the Youth League in the late 40s, and he was expelled from university for his work with the ANC Youth League, involving a visit of a government official to the campus where he was a student. And he later went to work within some government structures as a chief of the Buthelezi clan, which required government approval, and later as chief minister of the KwaZulu homeland. And I think throughout this time, there was no rift between Chief Buthelezi and the ANC. There's always been an element of ANC thought which believed that you could use and participate in government structures and use them as tools to gain more power and to gain political rights. And Chief Buthelezi went into the KwaZulu homeland structure with the approval, with the very quiet approval of the ANC. And in fact, things worked out very much the way the ANC hoped. Chief Buthelezi became chief minister. He refused to accept independence for the homeland, thereby throwing a monkey wrench into the government's plans for a grand apartheid that would make black citizens of separate independent countries and aliens in so-called white South Africa. And Chief Buthelezi also introduced ANC history in the KwaZulu schools. His political organization in Inkatha adopted ANC colors, the KwaZulu flag is the ANC flag, the Inkatha Youth Brigade uses the old ANC Youth Brigade uniforms, and I think things were very much on track until the late 70s.
What changed?
Things changed in the 1970s with the emergence of the Black Consciousness Movement. And the Black Consciousness Movement took a much harder line toward the question of participating in government structures. It saw this as futile, or as Biko said, it was like taking an unloaded gun and agreeing to a duel with someone. And it was just futile. And all it did, he thought, was to serve whites a myth that this was somehow a liberal country. And so they rejected this participation. The ANC, eager to attract recruits from the legions of black consciousness students who were fleeing the country following the Soweto uprising, wanted to distance itself from Chief Buthelezi. And in 1979, it had a meeting with him in London, which the ANC wanted to keep secret, and Chief Buthelezi wanted to make public, his line always having been that he will not negotiate or speak to anyone behind the backs of his people. But I think he very much wanted to be associated with the ANC and not to be viewed as a so-called stooge, which is what the ANC started calling him. And in the early 80s, there were clashes between Chief Buthelezi's Inkatha organizations and various student organizations and United Democratic Front affiliates that were loosely allied to the ANC. And things went from bad to worse and became very deadly. And once people started dying in some of these fights and attacks, there was a lot of bad blood, and that's just gotten worse and worse over the course of the decade. And so a lot of it is personal. A lot of what divides black politics in South Africa is strategy, not so much principle. And this question of strategy, do you participate in organizations or do you boycott organizations, has been an important dividing line in black politics. And in some ways, these issues, these strategic issues, are much more important than political ones.
Well, Buttigieg is opposed to economic sanctions, to violence, to boycotts, to strikes. I mean, what techniques would he be receptive to for fighting apartheid?
Well, that's exactly the question the ANC started asking after a while. I mean, here he seemed to oppose everything there was, and it was hard for them to see. It's hard for most people to see how the strategy of consumer boycotts, for example, really violates any sort of political principle. And I think this really, after a while, people started thinking, well, maybe he wasn't using the KwaZulu homeland to advance black political rights. Maybe he was using the KwaZulu homeland to advance his own ambitions. And I think the ANC decided that this is a man who's ambitious. He does have a thin skin. And I think he was seen as someone who was going to sacrifice the interests of black South Africans for his own personal interests. The KwaZulu homeland, as you know, is heavily subsidized by the government, and it enabled him to dispense a lot of patronage. Moreover, the more you saw the way he ran the KwaZulu homeland, and the closer you look at the KwaZulu homeland, the more doubt is cast on some of the liberal notions that Chief Buttigieg is espousing. Chief Buttigieg does not run the KwaZulu homeland as a liberal democracy. The KwaZulu homeland is a one-party state. Inkatha is the one party that dominates that, and opposition is really not tolerated in the KwaZulu assembly.
How much of the fighting between ANC members and Zulu Inkatha members is tribal, and how much of it do you think is political?
I think the fighting between ANC and Inkatha is not tribal at all, and I actually prefer not to use that word tribal because it suggests there's something barbarian about ethnic tension, which we don't say about ethnic tension elsewhere in the world where people massacre themselves over ethnic issues. But I think that it's important to realize that virtually all the fighting in Natal, which accounts for over 4,000 deaths in the last 3 years, has been between Zulus. Zulus of different political beliefs, Zulus who belong to different political organizations, because virtually everyone who lives in Natal, everyone who is black who lives in Natal, is Zulu.
And the fighting between the Zulus and Xhosas are it was mostly Xhosas who founded the ANC. You think that's largely a political fight?
Well, it's not Xhosas who've mostly founded the ANC. The Mandela is a Xhosa, and Tambo is Xhosa, the ANC, from the time it was created in 1912, went to tremendous pains to not be allied clearly with one ethnic group. Chief Luthuli, who was the ANC president throughout the 50s and who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1961, was Zulu. And there are other leading members of the organization who are Zulu and who come from other tribes, from Sutus and everything. And I think it's, if the ANC, more than any other political organization, has crossed ethnic boundaries, both ethnic and racial boundaries.
Do you think white conservatives in South Africa are using the fighting between Inkatha and the ANC as an excuse to slow down or oppose reforms?
Well, I think the fighting anywhere in the country, I think, serves the purposes of the white right wing, because what the government and the African National Congress are saying is that we can sit down like reasonable people and work out a resolution to the racial conflict, and that resolution will bring peace and stability to the country. And so anything that makes it seem as though that process of negotiating is not going to bring peace and stability, I believe, serves the interests of everyone who wants to see these negotiations fail. And I think that includes primarily the white right and some elements of black politics. I think to some extent Chief Buttigieg would not like to see that this negotiating process proceed peacefully without him. And I think the Pan-Africanist Congress has viewed the negotiating process as futile, and I think that the failure of that process would possibly serve their interests as well. But primarily, I think it's the white right that will gain the most from the failure of these talks.
You were there in the mid-80s. You were there for 3 years, left in 1987. Did you feel that you felt resistance techniques, that you saw resistance techniques change over the 3 years that you were there?
No, I think that the resistance techniques in the mid-80s, or throughout the 80s, were relatively consistent. People paid attention to grassroots concerns that people had. Organizations paid attention to grassroots concerns that people had, and tried to organize boycotts and consumer boycotts, rent boycotts, to try to apply pressure to the government. To some extent, techniques changed when the state of emergency was declared, both in 1985 and again in 1986, and a lot of people went underground. And that was the main development when I was there. So many people were on the run and in hiding.
And do you think being in hiding brought about a new form of resistance?
Well, I think that not so much a new form of resistance, but it turned some people toward more militant forms of resistance. Mm-hmm. I think the amazing thing about the state of emergency is that the government felt that this would intimidate black South Africans and bring the situation under control. In fact, it did just the opposite, because the state of emergency affected everyone in the townships, no matter who they were. If you were an executive at an advertising agency, if you were a mine worker, if you were a clerk, no matter what your politics were, you got stopped at roadblocks, you were affected by the curfew, and in fact, the state of emergency was the greatest organizing tool for the opposition that could ever be thought of. And so there was a tremendous sense of awakening in South Africa, a political awakening when I was there. And I think that's the important part of the 80s. And to some extent, it's a result of hard organizational work by organizations like trade unions and the United Democratic Front. And part of it was the work of the government by slapping on a state of emergency that affected everyone.
You make an interesting point. You say in the mid-80s, the government feared it had made the ANC leaders into martyrs by arresting some and forcing others into exile. So instead of banning the United Democratic Front in the mid-80s or arresting its leaders, it arrested a lot of the mid-level leaders who couldn't be made into as famous martyrs as easily.
Well, I think that's right. And part of what I try to do in the book is to describe some of these people who are not international celebrities and not martyrs on a national level, but were really local leaders doing the sort of hard nuts and bolts work of organizing communities and doing the things that eventually turned the country upside down. And these people aren't particularly famous. And they're the people who bore the brunt of repression in the 1980s. And I think they're going to remain a big factor in the country in the 90s, a factor both for the government and for the ANC to reckon with. There are strong, savvy leaders throughout the country.
What do you think are some of the new questions that the ANC has had to face now that it's no longer a banned organization?
Well, the ANC is an organization in tremendous flux since its unbanning. For one thing, it has to reconstruct an organization inside the country after having operated in exile primarily. And that's very difficult. It's proving much more difficult than they expected. You know, exile is kind of a punishment and an escape. And there's a certain amount of responsibility you don't have to take when you're in exile. And now, as an organization in South Africa, on the ground, it's held responsible for things that it wasn't held responsible for before. And it's had to grapple with things it hasn't had to grapple before. For example, what is the proper relationship between the ANC and civic organizations? Should civic organizations remain independent and unaligned to the ANC and include people from AZAPO and the PAC and all sorts of other strains of politics, or should they join together? Should clergymen be both members of the clergy and activists in the ANC? Bishop Tutu has asked Anglican clergymen not to join the ANC or not to become leaders of the ANC. These are the kinds of things we take for granted here to some extent, although not entirely, but which the ANC is first having to deal with. What should be the role, for example, of a trade union leader? Should a black trade union leader give up his trade union post when he decides to go into politics and join the ANC? I think there are other questions for the ANC too. For example, is the ANC a broad liberation movement that includes people of different political persuasions, which is a position that would be very helpful in negotiating with the government, Or is the ANC a political party with a definite set of beliefs?
What would be the difference in terms of what they could accomplish and how much force they'd have?
Well, to some extent, the two roles are at odds. I mean, if you're the broader they are and the less defined their platform, the bigger the advantage they have in negotiating a new constitution. But at the same time, other people are maneuvering for a position in a post-apartheid country and are mapping out positions. And the ANC's vagueness about some of the things it believes in on economics are losing its supporters, or risk losing supporters. So they're in a tough position.
You say that the ANC is expected to call for an end to selected economic sanctions within the year. Why would they do that?
I think for two reasons. One is that sanctions are crumbling. There are Turkey, Hungary, Chile, Argentina, the Soviet Union, countries that have traded with South Africa before, as well as countries that have never traded with South Africa before, are starting to open economic relations with the country. So to some extent, their shift, which I think will come sometime next year, hasn't come yet. I think the ANC's shift on the question of sanctions will, to some extent, be a recognition of reality. But I think just as important is the recognition that the economic crisis in South Africa cannot wait until the end of liberation. And if the ANC waits another 2 or 3 years before it starts to deal with some of the really pressing economic problems in the country, it will be a tremendously destabilizing factor in a post-apartheid society. And that would not serve their interests.
But don't you think that supporting an end to certain sanctions can be seen as giving in to the white government?
Well, I think so, and I think that's why they haven't done it yet. The main one, there's been an important shift on the question of sanctions in the last year or two, and that is the linking of the lifting of sanctions to what's called an irreversible process of change. And that's a phrase now you're hearing everywhere. Is this process irreversible? And it's a good question in its own right, but it has a special legalistic connotation, because if you believe the change is irreversible, you're not just saying that de Klerk's a good guy, but you're saying that perhaps he should lift sanctions. And so the ANC has been dancing around this question of whether or not change so far is on an irreversible course. And I think partly that's because they're trying to make up their minds, and partly because the implications of that would be to remove one of the main weapons that they've had in getting the government to the negotiating table. And I should say that I think that sanctions have made an impact on getting the government to the negotiating table. The sanctions have not brought the South African government to its knees, but it has slowed economic growth in the country for several years now and made it difficult to really make any headway. I think it's been a real factor in the government's thinking.
Journalist Stephen Mufsen is my guest, and he covered South Africa for 3 years for The Wall Street Journal, then for Business Week. He was expelled by the South African government in 1987. He's written a new book called Fighting Years, Black Resistance and the Struggle for a New South Africa. What do you think have been Nelson Mandela's greatest accomplishment since his release earlier this year?
Mandela's greatest accomplishment is in moving the process of negotiations forward.
Mm-hmm.
I think only someone of Mandela's stature could really accomplish that.
Yet there are many ways in which he's alienated his own admirers.
Well, I think so. And to some extent, that's to be expected. When you're in prison, people can ascribe any characteristics to you they like. And there's been an idealized idea of what Mandela is. It was inevitable that some people would be somewhat disappointed. In fact, it's extraordinary that more people haven't been disappointed. He is, as it turns out, an extraordinary person, and incredibly sure of himself, remarkably lacking in bitterness, and a real sense of dignity and authority about him. However, he's a bit of a plodding speaker. He doesn't do tremendously well at big rallies. He has been seen by some people to be a little bit vacillating on certain issues. And most, I think, the length of some of his foreign trips has surprised people, given how many pressing issues there are inside the country.
Negotiations between the government and the ANC are scheduled to start sometime in 1981. They'll be talking about a new constitution for South Africa. What other parties do you think have to join in these negotiations for them to really change life in South Africa for blacks?
Well, life in South Africa for blacks is going to change very slowly, no matter what happens at the negotiating table. The legacy of apartheid has been building up for so long that things just won't change overnight. But I think it is important to bring other people to the negotiating table, because you want people to work within a new constitution. You don't want them working outside it to undermine it. And so I think the more people that can be brought to the negotiating table, the better. And it doesn't take a large number of people to disrupt the political process. And in South Africa, there are some very well-armed and determined people among the white community especially, but also among the black community. And the more people who participate in this process, the better.
Are you optimistic about these talks between the ANC and the government?
I'm very optimistic, despite all the problems. And I'm optimistic because I think both sides have committed themselves to the idea of negotiations and to the success of negotiations. And if negotiations were to fail, I think it would prove the opponents of the ANC and the National Party correct. These are opponents both to the right and to the left. And so I think that after being at odds for decades, the National Party's interests and the ANC's interests have suddenly converged. And I think that's a fundamental change. And I think that's one reason why, despite the horrendous violence in the country this year, that the ANC and the government have not been deterred from this process. I think in normal circumstances, you would have expected all the violence that's taken place to disrupt the negotiating process. And I think that time is also of the essence for both the ANC and the National Party. The National Party is eager to get this settled so that they do not have to hold another all-white election, and which would be required by 1994 otherwise. And I think the ANC believes that time is of the essence, because a lot of the leaders of the ANC are very old men. Sisulu's in his late 70s. Mandela's in his early 70s. These are people who said back in the 1950s that they wanted to see freedom in their lifetimes. And here we are 35 years later, and I still think they're eager to see freedom in their lifetimes.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Stephen Mufsen. His new book is Fighting Years, Black Resistance and the Struggle for a New South Africa. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.